Chapter 17. Handling the paper. What does it say? For God's sake, read it out. You know the tongue. Mamsbury, with hesitation, I have glanced it through already more than once, a copy having reached me too, by now. We are in the presence of a great disaster. See here. It says that Mac, Angel Denome by Bonaparte from foresight shutting round capitulated, and with all his force laid down his arms before his conqueror. Pitt's face changes. A silence. Mulgrave, outrageous. Ignominy unparalleled. Pitt, by God, my lord, these statements must be false. These foreign prints are trustless as cheap jack dumbfounding yokels at a country fair. I heed no word of it. Impossible. What? 80,000 Austrians, nigh in touch with Russia's levies that couches of leads, to lay down arms before the war's begun? 'Tis too much. Mamsbury, but I fear it is too true. Note the asseverant source of the report, one beyond thought of minters of mock tales. The writer adds that military wits cry that the little corporal now makes war in a new way, using his soldiers' legs, and not their arms, to bring him victory. Ha ha! The quip must sting the corporal's foes. Pitt, after a pause, oh vacillating Prussia! Had she moved, had she but planted one foot firmly down, all this had been averted. I must go. 'Tis sure, I labor but in vain. Mamsbury accompanies him to the door, and Pitt walks away disquietedly towards Whitehall, the other two regarding him as he goes. Mulgrave, too swiftly he declines to feebleness, and these things well might shake a stouter frame. Mamsbury, of late the burden of all Europe's cares, of hiring and maintaining half her troops, his single pair of shoulders has upborne, thanks to the obstinacy of the king. His thin, strained face, his ready irritation, are ominous signs. He may not be for long. Mulgrave, he alters fast, indeed, as do events. Mamsbury, his labor's lost, and all our money gone. It looks as if this doughty coalition on which we have lavished so much pay and pains would end in wreck. Mulgrave, all is not over yet. The gathering Russian forces are unbroke. Mamsbury, well, we shall see. Should Boney vanquish these, and silence all resistance on that side, his move will then be backward to Bowlen, and so upon us. Mulgrave, Nelson to our defense. Mamsbury, eh, where is Nelson? Faith, by this time he may be sodden, churned in Biscay swirls, or blown to polar bears by boreal gales, or sleeping amorously in some calm cave on the Canaries or Atlantis's shore upon the bosom of his Dido deer, for all that we know. Never a sound of him, since passing Portland one September day to make for Cadiz, so 'twas then believed. Mulgrave, he's staunch. He's watching, or I am much deceived. Mulgrave departs. Mamsbury goes within. The scene shuts. Act 5, Scene I, off Cape Trafalgar, a bird's eye view of the sea discloses itself. It is daybreak, and the broad face of the ocean is fringed on its eastern edge by the Cape and the Spanish shore. On the rolling surface immediately beneath the eye, ranged more or less in two parallel lines running north and south, one group from the twain standing off somewhat, are the vessels of the combined French and Spanish navies, whose canvases, as the sun edges upward, shine in its rays like satin. On the western horizon two columns of ships appear in full sail, small as moths to the aerial vision. They are bearing down towards the combined squadrons. Recording Angel I intoning from his book, at last Villeneuve accepts the sea and fate, despite the Cadiz council called of late, whereat his stoutest captain's men the first, to do all mortals durst willing to sail, and bleed, and bear the worst, short of cold suicide, did yet opine that plunging mid those teeth of treble line and jaws of oaken wood held open by the English Navarchi with suasive breadth and artful modesty, would smack of purposeless foolhardihood. Recording Angel too, but word came, writ in mandatory mood, to put from Cadiz, gain Towlin, and straight at a set sign on Italy operate. Moreover that Villeneuve, arrived as planned, would find Rosalie in supreme command. Gloomy Villeneuve grows rash, and, darkly brave, leaps to meet war, storm, Nelson even the grave. Semi-chorus I of the year's aerial music, ear the concussion hurtle, draw abreast of the sea. Semi-chorus two, where Nelson's hulls are rising from the west, silently. Semi-chorus I, each linen wing outspread, each man and lad sworn to be, semi-chorus two, amid the vanmost, or for death, or glad victory. The point of sight descends till it is near the deck of the East Center, the flagship of Villeneuve. Present thereupon are the Admiral, his flag Captain Magendie, Lieutenant Dodignan, other naval officers and seamen. Magendie, all night we have read their signals in the air, whereby the peering frigates of their van have told them of our trend. Villeneuve, the enemy makes threat, as though to throw him on our stern. Signal the fleet to where, bid Gravina to come in from maneuvering with his 12, and range himself in line. Officers murmur. I say again, bid Gravina draw hither with his 12, and signal all to where, and come upon the larboard tack with every bow north, so we make catters in the worst event, and patch our racks up there. As we head now, our only practicable thoroughfare is through Gibraltar Strait, a fatal door. Signal to close the line and leave no gaps. Remember, too, what I have already told. Remind them of it now. They must not pause for signalings from me amid a strife whose chaos may prevent my clear discernment, or may forbid my signaling at all. The voice of honor then becomes the chief's. Listen they thereto, and set every stitch, to heave them on into the fiercest fight. Now I will sum up all. Heed well the charge. Each captain, petty officer, and man is only at his post when under fire. The ships of the whole fleet turn their bows from south to north as directed, and close up in two parallel curved columns, the concave side of each column being towards the enemy, and the interspaces of the first column being, in general, opposite the hulls of the second. An officer, straining his eyes towards the English fleet, how they skip on. Their overcrowded sail bulge like lone bladders in a tripeman's shop the market morning after slaughter day. Petty officer, it's morning before slaughter day with us, I make so bold to bode. The English admiral is seen to be signaling to his fleet. The signal is colon England expects every man to do his duty. A loud cheering from all the English ships comes undulating on the wind when the signal is read. Villeneuve, they are signaling too well, business soon begins. You will reserve your fire. And be it known, that we display no admiral's flags at all until the action's past. 'Twill puzzle them, and work to our advantage when we close. Yes, they are double ranked, I think, like us, but we shall see anon. Magendie, the foremost one makes for the Anta Ana. In such case the Augwu might assist her. Villeneuve, be it so, there's time enough. Our ships will be in place, and ready to speak back in iron words when theirs cry hail, in the same sort of voice. They prepare to receive the northernmost column of the enemy's ships headed by the Victory, trying the distance by an occasional single shot. During their suspense a discharge is heard southward, and turning they behold Collingwood at the head of his column in the Oil Sovereign, just engaging with the Spanish Anta Ana. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.